people's favorite comic book hero, followed by 84 million readers a year. Now, he comes alive. For the first time on the screen, you'll see it all. The spectacular adventures of the amazing Spider-Man.
He can do the things a spider does, you know, climb walls and spin webs, and he's very, very strong.
You've heard about him. You've read about him. Now, you'll see him in action.
Kill him.
Dazza, what did I just watch? Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Fat Man, and you're listening to On the Comic Couch Radio. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
I'm having this playing in the background for myself. I obviously have it muted, so you know the listeners don't have to be bothered with it. But wow, I mean, there's some stuff that's kind of cool, but it's like wow.
Yeah, that was actually the back in the at the end of the 70s, and the Spider-Man television show.
Ah, yeah, that's what we're here today. We're talking about specifically older TV shows as well as movies. And well, obviously we're going to open up with the discussion of the 1970s. You said it was a TV movie?
Yeah, I mean, basically the reason why I sort of came up with the idea for this particular show is last week we did the movies for 2016 of superhero movies. And I'd realized after we did it that we've got seven massive superhero blockbusters, all with big stars, all with big budgets.
Oh, speaking of that, let's do a bit of a follow up from last week's show. Have you seen the new Suicide Squad trailer?
Oh God,
yeah, it's amazing. It's complete 180 from the first one.
Times I've watched it.
It's amazing. Like I was telling our other host on Comic Conversations, I was talking to Marvel 2K, and I told him, even if the movie's bad, I don't care. That trailer was amazing, and now I'm going to buy a ticket.
Oh yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm not joking when I said I have watched that tons of times. I just think it's just a great trailer. And the thing is, it's Bohemian Rhapsody, so it's hard sort of do something with that music and not be great. But the way they basically tied in the beats of the song with like the bullets and the machine guns and everything, I just think as a work of art, that trailer was absolutely brilliant.
That thing I know it's got to win some awards. Like just that trailer alone, that thing was amazing. Like I said, even if the movie winds up being terrible, that trailer alone was worth, you know, paying for the movie.
Oh yeah, I mean, I absolutely do. I mean, we are getting to a stage where sometimes, you know, there's so much art now in the trailers. It's almost like VR, so it's like mini movies. I mean, if you saw like the Star Wars ones and everything, just you know, the trailers themselves are just like, you know, a work of art. But yeah, that Suicide Squad, it just looks absolutely fabulous, and I'm really hyped. I was hyped for that one anyway, but I'm really hyped for that one now.
Okay, speaking of mini movies, let's go back to our topic at hand. The Spider-Man 1970s, you said television movie, right?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the 70s, Marvel was sort of trying quite a few like TV movies and TV series. They did a Captain America, well, we did two Captain America ones. They did a Doctor Strange one in 1978.
Oh, this one I got to watch, actually.
Yeah. You're not missing out.
Oh, really? Does it have the train wreck appeal to it, or is it just boring?
The Doctor Strange one I found quite boring.
Oh.
To be honest, I've not seen Captain America ones. I've only seen little clips of it. Basically, in it, Captain America looks more like Evel Knievel because he spends most of the time on a red, white, and blue motorbike. what they did with these things is that they basically changed the actual, you know, the concepts of them quite a lot. So you have the main characters. So for example, Steve Rogers in Captain America ones, he was actually like an ex-Marine who was in a car accident, and when they basically gave him this like serum to heal him, he basically got his like superpowers and stuff. But it was already, you know, they didn't go with the ice or the sort of like the, you know, World War II background or anything.
Okay. Are these all 1970 series? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, they're all 1970 series.
Oh, okay.
And the Doctor Strange one, he wasn't a doctor, he was a psychologist. stuff. Yeah,
technically, you know, a doctor if he studied and got his doctorate in it.
Yeah. And then we had the Spider-Man one. And the Spider-Man one was actually a TV series. And once again, they basically did away with the with certain bits of the mythos. For example, his Uncle Ben never featured at all.
That's like the crucial thing to the character. That's something that, you know, that's his inspiration. It's like, okay, that's just something you're going to take away.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing that sort of drives the entire Spider-Man thing. But how they had it was that Spider-Man, and it wasn't a teenager either, it was basically like in adulthood. Once he basically got the Spider-Man powers, he pretty much basically just went out, made himself a costume, which looks really, really bad, by the way. It's a really awful looking costume, and just became like a superhero. And because it was a TV, show with a sort of a low budget and everything, you didn't get any of the iconic villains at all. It was basically the villains of the week just used to be like sort of gangsters.
That's exactly basically what my next question was going to be. So who do they pick to be the villain in this? And you say they had nobody.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was basically like most TV shows of the time. It wasn't like a story arc type series. It was basically each episode was just basically just, you know, one story. And it tended to be sort of just gangsters. I think there was one where they had sort of like some like ninja fighters and stuff. But generally speaking, it was just basically just going up against you.
On the clip you sent me, it opens up with Spider-Man finding a bunch of ninjas. And he's clung onto the wall, but it's not like he's particularly high up. And the ninjas just keep coming at him. And he just, you know, kind of lazily just kind of, and they keep running into his kicks.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty sort of dire. I mean, when I was a kid, I absolutely loved it, you know, because it was Spider-Man and everything. It was in, like, you know, live action and stuff. But the only characters from the comics that they had J.J. Jameson, J. Jonah Jameson character, and they had an Aunt May who appeared up. Rather strangely, Aunt May, every time she appeared, was played by a different actress. So it was very odd. The thing is, in America, this was actually a TV show. But what they did for the UK is, and they did this for quite a lot of your TV shows, is they actually took the pilot and basically brought it over to the UK and put it in the cinema as an actual film. And they did this again with Spider-Man. I think it was the only time they did a two-parter, and they put the two episodes together and again released that in the UK as a movie. And they did that with quite a few TV shows. The Battlestar Galactica got a cinema release.
I thought that was a movie first, and then it became a television show.
I thought it was just a pilot and then into a TV show.
Let's see. I'll investigate that as you start, just going off on the series.
Yeah. So anyway, to be honest, it was a very short-lived TV show. But like I said, there wasn't a lot that sort of, apart from the fact that it was Spider-Man, there wasn't a lot that tied it into the with the comic universe at all. And it was just sort of like, you know, a pretty, you know, run of your mill TV show. But this is kind of, you know, what we had, you know, as a kid. You know, this was basically what we had to, you know, as this was our Marvel universe, as it was. Yeah, and it the TV and the film itself, you know, the film as a kid, I loved it and everything. But when you sort of look back to it, it is very ropey. The special effects were really bad and everything. You know, the bits where he's sort of climbing over the wall, sometimes you could actually see the rope and everything. You know, I mean, I always remember there's actually a Spider-Man magazine, and they had some photos from the TV show, and there's one where you could actually see the where he's hanging upside down. You could see the bit of his sort of like in his outfit where the rope was pulling on the outfit, so his outfit was just coming up by just a little bit. It was really bad. But the one thing it did have, which was quite cool, is that they had his spider sense. So what used to happen is that when he sort of detected something around him, his face used to go into like a negative, like, you know, like a sort of negative.
That's kind of something cool to play with. I think that's even something in the 90s when they did the animated series, they sort of played with. It would sort of flicker like a negative, but it wouldn't be as I don't know if it'd be like severe. It would stay on the screen particularly long, but that's a cool idea that they obviously played with later. So.
Yeah,
it wasn't all bad.
Yeah, and he also had his spider tracers as well.
Oh, nice!
Which, Yeah, you know, which I don't think it ever featured in the film and stuff. So they had those little elements, but it's as a TV show, it's not got fond memories. It's not one of the ones that sort of, like, you know, people look back from and think, oh, you know, that was, like, you know, awesome or anything. Like, people look back to, like, the old Battlestar Galactica stuff, like Buck Rogers, and sort of remember fond times. But the Spider-Man one, not so much. It was pretty poor. It didn't last particularly long.
Yeah, speaking of Battlestar Galactica, I pulled that up. It was, in fact, a television show first.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was.
Okay. Yeah. Let's move on to our next topic, and let's let the music do all the introduction. I'm not gonna lie, I marked out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that was, of course, Batman.
Yes,
from 1989, the Tim Burton version. Now, I have to admit, I mean, this was, but even by 1989, we'd still not got a great deal of superhero movies.
No.
In the cinema. There's certainly no sort of, like, you know, really, really big budget ones. Now, I have to admit, I was not a big fan of the first one.
Really? It's one of those things to where I'm sure if you watch it now, it probably doesn't hold up, but it was one of those things I remember watching as a kid and I was floored with. I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. I mean, there was a massive, hype around this, you know, this film when it first came out. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, when I watched it, I was kind of just disappointed. It was weird because they were going for, like, a darker Batman, because before this, for a lot of people, the only Batman that they knew, who people weren't comic fans, was the old Adam West series.
Yes.
The very campy 60s Batman. So to get basically the said that this is going to be like a darker Batman, more to his roots, and you sort of have that, but it was still trying to be in the sort of, like, you know, the superhero sort of, you know, colourful, outlandish role. So it was, to me, it was always like a kind of a weird mix. And I have to say, you know, the thing that everyone goes on about is how great Jack Nicholson was as the Joker, and it was great casting. I have to say, well, looking back, I much prefer the Heath Ledger Joker.
Yeah, but to sort of paraphrase someone who we both know, Dave Meltzer, this movie wasn't made in the sense that it was going to be watched with 2016 eyes. No, it was for its time, and it made a ton of money, and for that, it did what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, and it really did sort of, you know, start off this, you know, because as we'll sort of get to later, the you know, superheroes movies had taken a bit of a hit, and this was one of the success stories that really sort of, you know, got it going. The one that I really liked the second one, which was
one of those films where, you know, obviously it's a sequel, they're gonna have a bigger budget, they've obviously proven to be a success, so they're gonna go more in that direction. But yeah, it's one of those things where if you watch it now, it's still good, and it's aged particularly well on top of that.
Yeah, definitely. But the second one, I absolutely loved. I think it just had this sort of more gothic feel to it, and just this darker thing. And you had Danny DeVito, I thought, was, you know, absolutely fabulous as the Penguin. It was, you know, really spooky. I mean, the Penguin's like one of those characters that there's not really a lot to go with it from the actual comics. It's like, you know, it's a guy with an umbrella and a bit of a snark and everything. But they just basically just did something just like really, really creepy with him and everything. Just gave him a sort of backstory, but sort of you had a bit of sympathy for as well, because he was basically sort of, like, you know, abandoned as a child and everything. I mean, you had Michelle Pfeiffer as the, Catwoman. You know, looking absolutely, you know, amazing. So, yeah, so I actually, you know, you know, the really important sort of, you know, films, the first two, you know, and the Tim Burton one. I wasn't, I mean, I mean, what do you think? Do you a fan of the second one?
Like I said, I was a big fan of the second one. It was one of those things to where I saw the original one, the first one, the initial one with Michael Keaton, and I thought it was good. But at the same time, I was young enough to where I was like, if I can get my hold, like if I get a hold of anything Batman, it's great. But this was literally in the sense that what a sequel is supposed to be, it's taking everything to the next level. They obviously had more money to play with, so there was obviously more production value. There was things that they could do in this movie that they didn't do in the first. So it's like I said earlier, it was what a sequel is supposed to be. It was bigger, badder, better. And it's one of those things where you can watch it now with 2016 eyes, and it's aged so well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And like you said, it wasn't easy, you know, trying to get a great story out of a character like the Penguin, but they managed to do it. They made him a compelling character, and they made him a big threat to Batman.
Yeah. I mean, I wish they'd have actually stayed with, you know, Tim Burton through the whole thing, but unfortunately he moved on. And then we had the Joe Schumacher.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's one of those things to where it's sort of like Star Wars Episode 1 to me, in the sense that I first saw it and I thought it was great. I had some reservations, a couple of things that happened in the movie, but then when I walked out, you know, that movie, I was like, yeah, it's pretty good. And it's just like Star Wars Episode 1 where everybody kind of looked at each other and they're like, that movie wasn't that great, was it? And it's like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I put the one good thing, I mean, for a start, I don't think Val Kilmer made a good Batman at all. You know, I
think that movie has a laundry list of things that were bad about that movie. And Val Kilmer being Bruce Wayne and Batman was, you know, a knock on the film, but at the same time, it's like there were so many things wrong with that movie. Like Val Kilmer being Batman is not high on my list.
Yeah.
Well, like we said, like I said, if you haven't listened to last week's show already, I'm of the opinion I'm not too, like, the casting never really affects me all that much with these movies. Like maybe it does with you, Daz, and I'm sure the vast majority of people will probably agree with you. But for me, I'm just like, it's a superhero movie. The story comes first. The casting, I mean, we're not dealing with performances that you're not, this is not a regular film. The crux of this film isn't how well the performances are. It's mainly what kind of stuff you can do as far as action, so.
Yeah. I mean, I personally thought Jim Carrey was great in it. And I know he seems to divide a lot of people. I personally thought it was, he was the only thing that I really enjoyed about this film as the Riddler.
It's one of those things to where it's fashionable to go back now and kind of crap on Jim Carrey, but I'm of the opinion that he over-delivered in the sense that you had this character who the Riddler was, who most people don't have that much, you know, affectionate for, I guess maybe from the 1960s series. I mean, the guy who they did get to play the Riddler was, in fact, very funny, so maybe I could see why they would feel the need to bring in someone like Jim Carrey, but it's almost one of those things to where I think it would have been great if they would have been able to go back and, you know, cast him as Joker, because he would have been fantastic. But it was one of those things where, well, they've already sort of established that they want, you know, this film franchise to be sort of to be interconnected, so all they had left was really the Riddler. But yeah, like I said, I think he over-delivered. In the sense that there wasn't really, you know, an expectations of what the Riddler was supposed to be. And the fact that he went out there and he delivered that kind of performance, I thought really was a credit to him.
Yeah. I think that's probably part of the problem is that the Riddler character and the Joker, they're sort of similar in some ways. And I think a lot of people thought that he was trying to do like a Joker impersonation. He was trying to be like Jack Nicholson, and I thought it was great. But yeah, it's not a movie that I particularly sort of liked. It just went after the world Tim Burton went. It just went really, really cartoony and everything. And I was not a fan. But it was to get worse.
Yes, I was about to say everything you didn't like about that movie. Just like I was talking about the original Batman movie, the sequel was everything you hated and more.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, when you see a film and you're groan at the trailer, that's not a good thing. When you hear Arnold Schwarzenegger going, "You're not taking me to the cooler," it's just like, oh, God, hey, this looks...
To awful. Their defense, who would have thought with the original Batman movie, Michael Keaton would have been made great Batman? That was one of those things where I'm kind of looking retroactively, and people were like, yeah, Michael Keaton as Batman, really? And going back to what I said earlier, I really, when it comes down to the films like this, I think the casting's not super important, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah. But, I mean, the film itself was not good.
No, not at all. By any stretch of the imagination, no. But that was really when the Nolan films came around, that was the hole that they were dealt with. That pretty much that killed the Batman franchise for years. I mean, we're talking what, at least maybe 10 years.
Well, that was 97. Let's see when. Sorry, I've got a nearly 8 years.
Yeah, so we're talking nearly a decade. That's how far back he said Batman, in the sense that he wanted to kind of, base it all off a lot off the 1968 series. And I'm just like, or I forget the year now. Is it 66 or 68 for the Adam West Batman?
I'm thinking 66.
Okay, that sounds right. Let's see if I can pull this up real quick as I try to stall. But it's one of those things where they try to bring it back to those roots, and I'm just like, I don't care. It's like you had this great series that Tim Burton was doing, and the fact that you kind of just went back on that and just – it felt like a betrayal. And it was 1966.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, that sort of Batman had run its course anyway. So even if Batman and Robin had been, really good, it had run its course. And there was only a few years after that when we sort of like the proper rebirth came along, when the X-Men came out, which I think is the one that really started the path to where we are today with the movies.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that was, to me, that one was, the X-Men being such a massive success, and they weren't sort of like, the major names that they are now, because they sort of like, they weren't like, the Superman or Spider-Man or Batman sort of thing. That sort of opened the gates that, these films can, we can basically sort of, take smaller characters and make good films out of them, because there is obviously a fan base there. And also you can make a more down-to-earth movie in that. So, going off topic a bit, that's what I thought that the X-Men did.
Yeah, it's funny that you brought up the fact that the X-Men movie, I was like, I was pretty sure that Spider-Man movie came out before then, but this is a credit to the X-Men movie. No, it came out in 2000. So this is something that, that prior to this, there was really no real market for superhero movies. And they made this movie, and it did really well. It really kind of got the ball rolling as far as all these comic book movies. Although, with that said, I think later on, to sort of get ahead of ourselves, I think we can also credit it to kind of see why the superhero genre kind of went away after a while. We can credit it to kind of going back to the Schumacher Batman, as well as the third X-Men edition of, did that kind of soured the market as far as the superheroes for a while.
Yeah, I guess so. But round about when Batman and Robin came out, if you look at this, because they were basically trying to make superhero films at that time, and a lot of them were real stinkers. I mean, you had Steel, which was you had Spawn, which was really, really, really awful. Just before that, you have the Judge Dredd movie. You have Phantom.
Shazam.
The Shadow. There was the Fantastic Four movie that, just a few years before that never got released.
Yes, I've seen the trailer and some of the images of that, and that's box off and poison right there.
You know what's really weird is I actually saw that film round about that time. Mm-hmm. And it's really weird because I had a friend of a friend who was basically like really, really into superhero stuff, and he was like a massive collector and stuff, and he somehow, and this is in the sort of like the this would be about sort of 96 97, he somehow had a videotape of that movie.
Now, is the story of this, not only did he have it, did he convince himself that it was good, and did he try to sell you on it?
No, he basically sort of he basically got it as a collector, and he said, do you want to watch this? And I think we got into about half an hour, and then we just sort of like said, okay, we've had enough.
I thought the story was going to be you got a hold of it, and with all the bad press it got, you got to round to watching it, and you were like, hey, this isn't that half bad.
No, I mean, the thing is, this film, I don't know where he got it from, because this film was never actually released.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know the history of a Fantastic Four movie, but what happened is
they made a documentary about it. That's how notorious this film is, in the sense that someone recently, I think it was maybe a couple years ago, decided to make a documentary about the making of this movie, the fact that they just wanted to make the movie so they can hold on to the rights.
Yeah, and the actors and everything, they thought that this film was actually going to get you know, released and stuff. I didn't know that we were basically just like doing this just for that purpose. But yeah, and I mean, to be honest, the videotape quality he had, it was like obviously like a fourth generation pirate copy,
a bootleg of a bootleg of a bootleg.
Yeah, which we sort of like, you know, had in those days. I mean, I messed up so many video recorders, like playing like Japanese wrestling and stuff on it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But yeah, so I've got going off a bit off topic there. But yeah, the basic gist is that superhero movies, it was a long road to get to, and there were many false starts to get to where we are today, basically.
Okay, since we're talking about sort of the parallel of modern movies compared to older films, let's move on to our next topic, which, since we're talking all things Batman, the natural inclination would be to move on to our next topic. Yeah. now, like prior to the Spider-Man talk, and I know a lot of people are going to get mad at me when I say this, but these films I have not watched.
Really?
Yeah. This is the one thing in the sense that this is sort of unforgivable territory. I mean, naturally, I think people are going to forgive me for not watching that Spider-Man TV movie, but that's one of those things where I've never been a big Superman guy. And obviously, I'm younger, so I would not have seen these films when they were coming out. And like I said, most of my life, I did not been a fan of superheroes as well as Superman. So I never had the inclination to watch this movie. Even though, with that said, it is sort of something that's become part of pop culture in the sense that it's something that everyone's seen, even people that don't like superheroes. So I sort of have no excuse for not watching these films.
Yeah, I mean, well, you should watch certain of these Superman films for very different reasons, which I will get to you. The first Superman film, I was about 5 years old. I think it was one of the first films I ever went to the cinema to see. And I must have had a lot of patience because this film, it takes a long time to actually get to Superman.
Oh, really?
Because you have basically the whole Krypton story. There's this like weird scene where General Zod is basically put on trial, which basically doesn't pay off until the next Superman movie.
That's kind of so cool, and that's kind of, you know, ambitious in the sense that more often than not, you'll see with films, they'll be very quickly, they want to, we're going to establish something because it's going to pay off later on in the film. So mm-hmm. The fact that they were ambitious to say, you know what, we're going to set up something, and we're so confident that there's going to be other movies down the road, we're going to establish something now and come back to it later.
Well, Superman and Superman 2 were filmed simultaneously.
Oh, that I didn't know.
Yeah, they were filming them both at the same time. When basically Superman came out, 80% of Superman 2 had already been
nice.
Completed. Because if you look, it was like a 2-year gap between the two films.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So they obviously had a lot of sort of faith in what they were doing. And Superman, it's one of those films that, out of all the superhero movies, I'm not saying it's the best superhero movie because, you know, the ones like, you know, the more modern ones in many ways are superior. I don't think any of the superhero films have caught the tone, the comic book tone of a film as Superman.
Huh.
Because it really, for a start, the look of it, the actual, you know, I mean, Superman's costume and it overall, and this is a film that would not, pardon my pun, fly today, because it was, the Superman outfit and everything, it's a very much a film of the 70s, and there's like a real optimistic, fantasy tone to it. But to me, you know, everything, not just from like Superman himself, but the actual, how the city is, how the city runs with, the regular people's reactions to Superman and everything, it feels like an actual comic book on the screen. And it's one of those things that I just can't put my finger on it why, but it just feels really, really authentic. And there's just like a real sense of wonder about the whole thing. I mean, the tagline was like, you know, you'll believe a man can fly.
Okay.
So of course, the special effects have got, have obviously got a lot better and everything. But what they do with the special effects that they've got is like, you know, tremendous. I mean, there's like a real, when you see Superman flying and he's landing and everything, there's like a real grace and just this like real like class to the whole thing. It's just as a cinema, it's just a beautifully filmed movie.
Mm.
And it does have a little bit of a campy feel to it and everything. And, you know, and so, you know, it was a time when this is super, the first Superman film was built, was made when the blockbusters were just really, really starting. Cause you had sort of like films like Star Wars, like Close Encounters, Jaws and stuff like that. And it sort of fits some of those. And there is like kind of like a feel good, optimistic feel to Superman, which I think basically does, you know, fit in with it. And, you know, Gene Hackman in it is great as Lex Luthor. You know, he's actually, you know, he's absolutely fantastic. But Christopher Reeve as well, he does the role so well. There's just something about that role, because his whole sort of like persona with like the truth, justice, American way thing is like a corny sort of ideal. But there's just something about Christopher Reeve. He's got this like innocent charisma that basically manages to pull it off. Without it being too hokey, it just sort of, you know, works. And it's just like loads and loads of like wonderful scenes. Like there's one scene where he takes Lois Lane flying and everything. And like I said, the special effects, it's sort of all blue screen. You know, it's not the days of CGI. But it's just for me, it's just, you know, a fabulously, you know, worked film. And, you know, and it's something that, If it's like on TV or something like that, I just happen to be watching it, I'll end up like, you know, watching parts of it, because it's just like, you know, such a well done film. I mean, when Superman actually does, you know, finally arrive in it, that scene where he basically sort of walks out of the building and Lois Lane is in this like helicopter accident and the helicopter's hanging over the building and it's like a big crowd and everything, we're all looking up, and he basically turns into Superman for the first time and saves her. And it's just this like, you know, just this really well worked scene. It's, you know, it's just like one of those sort of like really iconic scenes. And when he captures her, he says to her something along the lines of, you know, I've got you. And then she goes, you've got me. Who's got you? And it's just like,
that's actually a nice little bit. Yeah. I like that.
And and then he catches the helicopter and everything. And it's just a real, and then the sort of the music that you were playing now just like, you know, comes into play. And it's just this like, this really amazing scene. It just sort of makes you sort of like, you know, this thing that wouldn't it be great if we did have this like sort of like superhero out there looking out for us and everything. It's just like a really optimistic, like, you know, feel good film.
Okay, so as someone who's not a big fan of the Superman character and lore, would you recommend this movie to me?
I would. And in fact, I mean, I personally wouldn't just recommend this film to, like, you know, comic book fans. I would actually recommend this to anyone who actually likes cinema or the history of film.
Yeah, that's one of those things I sort of, you know, illustrated earlier, in the sense that this movie is a pop culture thing. It's part of, you know, the world's lexicon of, you know, everything. It's not just Superman, but specifically the Superman film. So
yeah, and it does. And whenever people like do their like most important movie, you know, 100 movies or the top 100 movies, it always like, you know, figures, you know, really well in there. If you ever see like a film encyclopedia, chances are in some way when it gets to the 70s, you'll see a picture of, you know, of Christopher Reeve in the Superman outfit.
Yeah, it's something not delegated just in the pantheon of superhero movies. It's something that just, when you talk American films, it's one of those things that it's always in the discussion.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And then we had, Superman 2, of course, which is in many ways is just as good, and in many ways it's... in some ways it's a better film as well, because Superman is as great a film it is, with certain scenes which are quite ponderous and such, you know, and it does take a long, you know, because the first part of it is like an origin story, so it does take a long way to get into the action. But Superman 2 is, you know, is absolutely great as an action film, because it takes one of my problems was with Man of Steel is that it basically, I thought it didn't, as a movie, it basically made the big threat in the first movie, whereas this one's really good. It introduces Superman as this like hero and everything saves the day, and then in the second one it brings in three guys, well, two guys and a girl, who have the same powers as Superman, so it brings in the big threat in the second movie. So you've seen Superman dealing with all these sort of threats, now how is he going to cope when they're basically when he's not the strongest guy in the room when he's got three people who've got the same powers as him and he's outnumbered. And it's got Terrence Stamp as Zod, who is absolutely great. There's a lot more humour in this one. And a lot of the humour, surprisingly, comes from the three villains. Because when they come to Earth and they basically land in this, like, you know, small little sort of town in the middle of nowhere, and how they interact with the locals and everything. And it's just, you know, they go into a bar and they basically, a guy cracks onto the Ursula's of a woman, and she basically, like, arms wrestled him to the floor and everything. There's just all these, like, little sort of comedy bits. And then it really, when they actually start taking over and everything, it sort of, like, you know, really, you know, he actually, you know, really ramps up. But Terrence Stamp's absolutely awesome. He's just sort of like, you know, just, he has so many quotable lines, like, you know, kneel before Zod, and there's a bit where he sort of confronts the president and does this line where he says, "You are not the president. You know, no one who leads so many would bow so quickly." Just all these one-liners that he's got. And it's got the really good, great scene in it is the actual, you know, the big battle where Superman takes on the three things, and it's just it's one of these things where less is more, because the special effects being what we will be able to make every sort of scene count. Mm-hmm. So they do this, like, sort of big battle scene, and now with CGI you can basically just have, like, buildings being destroyed left, right and center and everything, whereas they had to sort of, like, do each like clash between them had to be special, so they're basically throwing each other into sort of buildings and everything. Incidentally, this scene is actually hilarious for certain reasons, one of them being that there is so much product placement in the scene. It's absolutely hysterical, because we're like throwing each other into like these sort of buildings and that. So at one minute, they'll like throw somebody into a big Coca-Cola sign, and then Superman will get thrown into a truck that's basically a Marlboro cigarette truck and everything. And it's just all these scenes like that. There's just loads and loads of actual like product placement. It's absolutely hilarious. There's also this really funny scene where they think that basically that the villains have killed Superman, and all the crowd's like watching and cheering on. And all these like this guy suddenly shouts, "They killed Superman." And then someone says, "Let's get him." So they actually start marching up these streets. It's absolutely brilliant. And they're like picking up like bits of wood and like traffic cones and like stuff like that. And so to start marching on these three guys who basically have, like, you know, killed Superman and stuff.
That is funny. I'm not gonna lie.
I have to say as well, and this is a big spoiler anyway, just in case you've not seen a film from 1980.
That's fine. I have no excuse. So yeah. Spoil away.
Yeah, everyone goes so ape about the fact that Superman kills Zod in Man of Steel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this one, the Christopher Reeve Superman, who is like a sort of a more optimistic, you know, time, he kills in this movie.
So for all the outrage over the Man of Steel, he kills him in this too, right?
Yeah, he kills General Zod. But get this, in the Man of Steel, he basically killed General Zod to save lives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because that was he had to basically snap his neck to save lives. In this one, he basically, the trick is that Superman can't beat the three of them. So he manages to basically trick them by stealing their powers. So he reduces them to like human, to regular humans. And when he kills General Zod, he basically crushes his hand and throws him into this sort of ice pit, you know. So he's basically killing a defenseless human being.
That's even worse than what happens in Man of Steel. Yeah.
But then get this, and then Lois Lane kills Ursula. She punches her and pushes her into the same like ice pit. So, you know, so the whole thing about sort of like, you know, Man of Steel kills, you know, Christopher Reeve kills. He kills the defenseless guy. So he's practically doing it out of revenge, because there's no reason for him to actually kill.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, so that's just a, you know, a thing that I sort of remember about Superman 2.
Now, are those most of your memories, or should we move on to our next topic?
I have to say, basically, the quality of those films went massively down. Because Superman 3, basically, it became more of a slapstick comedy, and which I personally liked it because I had Richard Pryor in, and I love Richard Pryor, so I actually enjoy that movie. Superman 4 is, I mean, you must have heard about this, is one of the worst movies ever
made. That's what I've heard, yes.
It is absolutely dreadful for so many reasons. Basically, what happened is the Superman 3 was basically sort of took, you know, a lot less than the other two films. And then they made a Supergirl movie as well, which was absolutely dreadful. Geez. And that was a massive box office bomb. So basically the Warners weren't interested in making any more Superman films. So what they, what happened is this, this studio called Canon, who are basically, they basically specialize in making really cheap action films. They made a lot of Chuck Norris films, a lot of martial art films, that sort of thing. They bought the rights to what, to the Superman franchise. And I remember seeing this when I was I'd be in my teens, and it was the first film that I remember seeing and thinking, this is not right. Because the opening credits just looked like they'd been done on a computer, or on a home computer.
Ooh.
The special effects just looked really, really bad. It opened with like a scene where Superman's like saving this space station. And you just, I'm watching it, I'm just thinking, there's something wrong here. The special effects are just so awful. And they basically just done the entire movie on the cheap.
Yeah, they figured they did all their work with their first couple of films. This is the ones where they make the money.
Yeah, well, like I say, it was a whole new studio that had it now. Like I said, it's Canon Films, so they were basically like doing, you know, basically just trying to make a fast buck. The only reason Christopher Reeve did this film, he didn't want to actually do the film. He was done with Superman. The only reason he did the film was that they did a deal where they would fund this crime film that he wanted to make. And he apparently, there's a young kid who plays Lex Luthor's nephew in it, and this actor was like really excited because he was in a Superman film. And Christopher Reeve went out to dinner one time after filming, and Christopher Reeve just said to him, "Look, just so you know, this movie is going to be awful." Apparently, because there's a really infamous thing about this film is that there's like one flying shot of Superman flying towards the screen, and they use it again and again and again. The flying special effects scenes would take about a week to do, and they just did it like in one afternoon.
Ouch.
There's one scene which is, because basically what we tried to do is we tried to make Metropolis, we tried to make New York out of Milton Keynes, because the film, the outdoor scenes in Milton Keynes in England, which I don't know if you know much about Milton Keynes, but it's a really sort of like dire industrial city.
Oh, okay.
And there's a scene where Superman is supposedly walking towards the United Nations building. And it's basically, everyone knows what the United Nations building is. They basically used a bus station in Milton Keynes. There's a scene of like Superman walking across a car park with this young kid. There's no extras around. I mean, because you'll think Superman walking towards the United Nations would like get a crowd of people watching. There's no crowd. The only thing that they've got is they've got like a they've like made up a yellow fire hydrant, and they've got a yellow school bus to make it look like America a bit. It's just like, you know, everything we did was on the cheap. It's absolutely awful. It's one of those films, though, that it is actually worth watching because it is so bad, it's funny. One thing as well is there is a DVD with the DVD commentary from the director. It is the funniest commentary I have ever heard.
Wow.
Because it's like one long apology from the director. You know, it just like the first things that come out of his mouth are something along the lines of, "We had all the best intentions in the world when we were making this film."
Sure, you did.
Yeah, it's just like, it's just a hilarious commentary where he's basically just admitting how bad it is. You need to see it because just to see how bad this film is. It's sort of film that if Mystery Science Theater 3000 was still going, they'd be able to make a entire episode about.
They still make stuff, Dazza.
It's coming back, isn't it?
Yeah, not only does it come back, it never went anywhere. They went to the internet, and they would do is they would sell you an MP3, and you would play the MP3 as soon as the movie starts, and you would have their commentary to go with whatever film you had. They got a couple of rights, so obviously they made everything in-house. But a couple of instances, I think you can, let's see if you can find this at rifftracks.com.
Right,
they have, you know, everything from, I don't know, contemporary films, Jurassic World, to even the Avengers movies. So they never stopped doing stuff like this. And the movie you're talking about, to sort of go back to our discussion, is Superman IV: The Quest for Peace. I've heard, yes, this is a notorious film that I've heard about.
Yeah. I mean, it's got like the, you know, this, like this, the villain in it is a guy called Nuclear Man. Mm-hmm. And he actually, the actor in it apparently never got a role again. He was so bad in it. He kind of looked the part. He had this sort of like, you know, long blonde, you know, hair and everything. But the film itself was just sort of just, it's one of those rare things that sometimes you'll get films which are sort of bad films, but like, you know, the well produced. This just isn't well made. It's just like cheaply made. But this one scene it as well, which is like a comedy piece that goes on forever, where Clark Kent's got a girlfriend, and obviously Lois Lane is with Superman, and they kind of arrange like a double date thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what you get is basically you'll get like sort of Clark Kent coming in the door, and then he'll find an excuse to go outside.
Oh, God. Superman. So it's been, Superman's been resorted to sitcom humor.
Yeah. And then Superman, and basically he changes to Superman, and then like comes onto the balcony to talk to Lois Lane, and then when her back's turned, he flies off again, and then comes around the door as Clark Kent. It's just like this really bad, like, comedy, sort of, you know, sitcom-type scene. And it just goes on forever. And like I said, I as a kid was, like, watching it and just thinking, this is bad. This is... And I was, you know, like a teenager when you can sort of, like, you know, pretty much foist any sort of old bad movies on, like, you know. But I was watching it and just thinking, God, this is just like really poorly made. And even then I didn't know jack about films or film production or anything, but even then I knew that something was really, really, you know, bad. And because of this, apparently some superhero films actually got canned because it did so badly at the even as cheap as it was, you know, it basically was like, you know, a really bad business move.
Ouch.
And like, apparently there was supposed to be a Spider-Man film that was like being planned back in the 80s, and because this performed so poorly, it was that got canned.
Oh, geez Louise. Oh, my God.
Yeah. But it's definitely, it's worth watching. What I would recommend is getting some friends around, who are sort of into the same sort of thing, getting a few beers and basically just sitting watching it and just totally ripping into it, because it's just, it is an hilarious film to watch.
Let's see if there's a riff track for it. I'm curious now. Superman 4 riff track. Let's see.
There is a, do you ever watch the Honest Trailers?
Yes.
Yeah, there is one for Superman 4, which kind of sort of, you know, brings everything. Raises all the key points of it, so you know.
Yeah, here, there's one on rifftracks.com for the low price of $2.
Oh, I mean,
you get the audio track. Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't heard of that. Yeah, all right, let's move on to our next film, Captain America.
Where'd you get your guinea pig?
Happens to be the best damn candidate out of 600 volunteers.
A secret experiment gave one man the strength of 100.
The rest of the world, he's just codenamed Captain America.
And the power to save millions.
The Jerry's had an experimental rocket ready to fire at a target somewhere in the United States.
Only he could defeat a superhuman madman.
They got a fella called the Red Skull heading up their outfit. All's we can hope to get in there is one good man.
Wow. I think I remember watching this as a kid. Now I'm looking at this now, and it's so bad, Dazza.
It is. I mean, this. I remember it to be at the end of the 80s, I guess, when I was reading Marvel Comics, and they made mention that there was going to be a live-action Captain America movie. You know, so I was like, sort of, great, another superhero film. And then it never materialized. And again, it was produced by Cannon, who did...
Oh, God, the dreaded Superman 4, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently it basically was one of these films that had a really troubled history getting onto the screen. When they made it, they pretty much shelved it. They didn't give it a theatrical release and just ended up releasing it on video. I saw this. I just happened to see this by chance many years later. It was I think it was on the Sci-Fi Channel on in the UK, and I sort of like started watching it, and it was just like, oh God, this is just so absolutely awful. It was just so cheaply made. I mean, but the unusual thing about this one, which sort of gives it a sort of, you know, is quite a sort of like a bit of a turning point, is it actually stuck sort of close to the actual, whereas the other ones would basically just do away with the origins and just do it, you know. This one at least stuck to the thing where having him basically, having an actual villain from the comic books in mm-hmm. Red Skull, which most of the other films never did.
They really?
Never, Most. I mean, like for example, the early Captain America, the two TV movies didn't have any villains from the actual Captain America comics. Again, they just had gangsters in there. Oh, that was geez. Just like, you know, the key things that we used to do. Whereas this one did actually, you know, try to do a, at least in Marvel's terms, they actually tried to give them, an actual, Red Skull villain. And they also did the thing of him basically being from World War II and being in the ice and everything like that. But the film itself, today I looked it up on YouTube to find some footage just to remind myself of it. And it is so bad. I mean, I watched the final scenes of it with, the final battle with the Red Skull. It's just so poorly made. And Captain America, he does this like really weird thing where he tries to emulate, you've not seen them, so you don't know, but in the Superman films, Christopher Reeve always used to have a thing where at the end, as he'd fly towards the camera, he'd kind of smile at the camera. Like,
Seen that before, Dazza. Cut me some slack.
Oh, right, okay. Well, they tried to do that in this one with Captain America. They kind of have him sort of like, he basically dispatches the main female villain mm-hmm. with his shield, and when he turns around to the camera and kind of like tries to do like a sort of smile, but just comes across with this like weird, smug sort of look about him. It's just a really, really bad film, basically.
No, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Great. Let's keep with the. You know what? We talked about this before. You pitched it toward me, and it was funny enough to where I'm like, let's talk about it. But then, as we started marching closer and closer to the show, you're like, I have some reservations on this. But I said, let's just have some fun. And of course, I'm referring to Condor Man. Which, judging from the music, I don't think this was played up very seriously, Dazza.
No.
Okay, tell us about Condor Man.
Okay. Well, Condor Man was from 1981, and I basically went... And it was by Disney. And it was a Disney superhero film. Now, I sort of went to this as a kid, and I have to say, I did actually love it as a kid, this film, but I went there thinking I was going to see a superhero movie, because the poster had basically sort of like this guy with sort of like wings, or the trailer showed him like flying and everything like that, and he had all this like, James Bond like car that fired lasers and everything, but what it actually was more of a comedy. And it was a it was played by a guy whose name I have forgot. But Michael Crawford, who actually in the UK was like a household name. He did a TV comedy show called Some Mothers Do Have Them. So in the UK, was really well known. And he also had Oliver Reed in as the main bad guy. He was obviously basically just wanting his beer money at that time. And the premise of this film was that he was a comic book writer who basically would always basically test out all his equipment and everything. And to cut a long story short, the story was that he basically got involved in this spy story. And part of his sort of like his price for working, with the government was that they had to basically make all the equipment from his comic books. So he ended up with sort of like, the super speedboat, the supercar and everything. So it was kind of just like, sort of like a comedy, but he was sort of, almost like a falcon type outfit with the wings and everything.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, like James Bond type gadgets and stuff like that. So it was kind of, as a kid, I really, really enjoyed it, but it wasn't the superhero film that I was, basically expecting. Funnily enough, it is by Disney. So it is possible, theoretically, it is possible that they could bring back Condor Man into the Marvel Universe.
I wouldn't hold your breath, maybe as a joke.
I think it would work great as a character in, say, like Howard the Duck or something like that. It's like, failed superhero. It did actually, in one of the Toy Story movies, there's a scene where there's all these, like, discarded toys. We have, like, this therapy session group. And they've got like, they've got all like sort of the toys from all the McDonald's packs and everything, which have all basically like, you know, been discarded. And they've actually got one of the toys is a Condor Man figure.
Yeah, let me look this up. I think it's going to be the show description. Condor Man Toy Story. Let's look this up. Oh my God, it's the first thing that comes up. Yes. He's got like a giant head and he's driving like a little, like a Cadillac. Hey, what's the term I'm looking for? He's just driving a car.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, it's a real, it's one of those films that as a kid I love for this, you know, and everything. But when you sort of like look back on it, it is not good. I mean, there's a scene where he basically there's one scene where he flies as Condor Man, and you can tell it's obviously as he's sort of like, you know, flying, that there's obviously like a crane above him. Sort of like, carrying him and everything. It's just a really bad film, but it's kind of, you know.
They're trying to create a better visual image for you. It's like a normal Hot Wheels race car, and on top of it is like a superimposed, he's got a giant head, and he's sticking out of it like a convertible. And he's driving it like a go-kart.
Yeah.
Wow. See, Daz, aren't you glad we talked Condor Man?
Condor Man, yeah.
All right, let's...
Just a final thing on Condor Man. It does end with a little thing where somebody says, hey, have you ever thought of taking Condor Man to... And then he whispers. And then they all like look at each other and like smile as if this was actually going to be a franchise where they were going to do a Condor Man 2. Unfortunately, it never came around.
Oh, poor Condor Man can't get a break. All right, let's take our next superhero, which is The Incredible Hulk, the 1978 series.
Dr. David Banner, physician, scientist, searching for a way to tap into the hidden strengths that all humans have. Then an accidental overdose of gamma radiation alters his body chemistry. And now when David Banner grows angry or outraged, a startling metamorphosis occurs. The creature is driven by rage and pursued by an investigative reporter.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yeah. David Banner.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Apparently, according to Stan Lee, the reason why they actually changed the name of Bruce Banner to David Banner is that Bruce was considered too gay a name.
Yeah, that's what I heard. That's exactly what I was about. That's the first thing I was going to say just now. The fact that they had to change his name because of stuff like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, this was like a really big deal back when I was a kid, this TV series.
Sort of going back to what we were talking earlier about the Superman series, this is something that's not really just exclusive to the comic book series. This is something that, you know, when you talk about the 70s lexicon, this is something right up there.
Yeah. I mean, if you ever watch something like Family Guy, this is the sort of thing that will get referenced so many times. I mean, I know of at least, twice that they have referenced this, this TV series. And that's, you know, I mean, Seth MacFarlane, I think, is actually sort of, you know, sometimes I think he's speaking to me because he...
Just you, Dazza, you're the one.
Yeah. Anytime he does like a gag or a reference of some TV, I always get it, you know, every single time. But yeah, this is, this is back in the day when TV shows that they didn't like have sort of, a lot of them didn't have like a continuous arc. They were very like self-contained episodes. Mm-hmm. And this, for example, the Hulk, it was sort of the same format as a film, a TV show like The Fugitive, mm-hmm, or Kung Fu, where the idea is that you will get this character who will basically be going from place to place. He'd arrive somewhere at the start, like, you know, it was a bit of a drifter. It would get into some sort of adventure or some sort of trouble on a local thing. And then at the end of the episode, he'd basically move on to his basically, you know, his next
adventure,
town.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, part of this was basically it helped when, you know, with TV shows selling them into syndication and doing them as repeats and stuff like that. But it did make them really accessible to basically just, you know, watch them. Of course, this being, you know, the 70s, special effects being what they were, they didn't bother, you know, they couldn't have basically a CGI Hulk. Mm-hmm. What they did is they basically just got this like really big, you know, muscly guy and basically just painted in green.
Which, you know, if you've seen the other Hulk movies that they made prior to this, maybe they were better off because, wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, the first time I saw this as a little kid, I was absolutely terrified by the Hulk. Because, and it was obviously some days that I realized that he was the good guy. But the first episodes, he absolutely terrified me.
Yeah, and the actor you're referring to is Lou Ferrigno.
Yes, who was at one point almost in the WBF.
it's a shame they didn't. He would have been so great. No, he wouldn't have been terrible.
He actually does appear in one of the Incredible Hulk films as an extra.
Huh.
You know,
they've done that several times. Yeah, he's been in most of the Hulk films since then. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but as a TV show, you know, I loved it. It was like, you know, quite popular at the time and everything. And it had this iconic music at the end when he was like walking off trying to hitch a ride and everything. but the TV show, it ran its course. And then in 1988, they basically decided to bring the Hulk back as a series of TV movies.
Okay.
And this was actually, for its time, quite groundbreaking in what they did, in the fact that this was the first time when they actually had crossovers with other heroes. Because in the first one, The Incredible Hulk Returns, so basically the premise was that he basically managed to go 2 years without having a Hulk incident.
Oh, okay.
Incidentally, the transformation that he used to go through from him to the Hulk was quite dramatic, because he basically would get like angry, and then his eyes would basically go green first, and then you'd sort of like slowly, as you know, he'd sort of, we would be like almost like a werewolf type transformation, you know, into the Hulk, and his sort of like clothes were ripping and everything. So it was quite a dramatic, you know, scene in that. But anyway, but basically the idea was he'd not gone through any transformations, and then a guy by the name of Donald Blake came along. And what actually happened is Donald Blake, of course, from the comics, is basically Thor's alter ego.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, he basically had had a backstory where he'd basically had the power to basically summon Thor. So he basically comes to Bruce Banner for help, and he basically sort of brings Thor along. And so you get Thor and an Incredible Hulk in the same film. And obviously, but Thor being like, you know, a bit of a dick, he basically starts like pushing Banner around, and Banner turns into the Hulk. And so you basically had your first actual superhero versus superhero clash.
Oh.
In a movie, in his. And to me at the time, that was quite, you know, exciting and groundbreaking, that you had sort of, you know, that they were bringing other characters into, like, you know, almost, you know, into the Hulk franchise. So you're getting, like, at the time, a mini Marvel universe. And the Hulk, it has to be said that the Thor guy is basically a very shoddy Thor.
I've seen this. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's not the Thor we think of when you know the original comic book. It looks like it's just a guy dressed up in Viking garb, and yeah, he's got a hammer, but it's like it looks very low rent.
Yeah, and this was actually designed to basically spin off into a Thor TV series, which of course never actually happened. But
it could have worked. But yeah, the costume is just. It's tragic. He's wearing like his armor
like
vest.
It looks like Dungeons & Dragons cosplay.
Yeah, he's got like an armor chest plate, and it's got like a fur on the sides for shoulders. I'm just like, in the sense that they kept Hulk more or less the way he looks in the comic books, but they felt the need to change Thor.
Yeah, yeah. It did not look good. But, you know, at the time when, you know, any time that you actually did something, brought in like a new, you know, character, you know, onto the screen, I got a little, you know, excited about it. I used to be the same with the comics. When for example, when they had I used to watch the Spider-Man TV show, and when they actually had the X-Men coming for a couple of episodes, you know, I got really excited by that, you know. So, you know, By. But anyway, they actually followed this up with another film called The Trial of the Incredible Hulk.
Oh, jeez.
And in this one, they had Daredevil.
Oh, nice. Kingpin. Yeah, yeah, in fact, that's what I'm looking up right now. You mentioned that the fact there were all these series of television shows or movies, and see, I have it pulled up right here in front of me. Yeah, there's a Hulk, a Captain America with the helmet, and one of them is Daredevil, but it looks like he's donned all in black.
Yeah, and they also have the Kingpin in there as well. And again, the idea about having this one is that they were hoping to have Daredevil have his own TV series off of this, and again, that came to nothing. So yes, but you know, so again, you had you had another character added to the mix. They finished it off these films with the death of the Incredible Hulk, and originally they were supposed to have the She-Hulk in this.
Mm-hmm.
And around that time, they were actually flirting with the possibility of having a She-Hulk movie, and Bridget Nielsen was basically the one who was basically pegged to play her. They actually did some test footage and some some photographs of her as She-Hulk, but it never came to pass. So She-Hulk never actually appeared in this. There is actually a character in here who's a female Russian spy who is very much like the Black Widow. Now, I remember watching this at the time, and I sort of, my memory played a bit of tricks with me. I thought it was actually the Black Widow, isn't it? But it actually wasn't. It was a new character, but it, to all intents and purposes, it was basically like a Black Widow type character. They just didn't give her the Black Widow name. And they were actually planning as well to finish this off with another film called The Revenge of the Incredible Hulk. And apparently that one was supposed to have brought in Iron Man.
Ah.
Now, yeah. But that never actually got made. What an Iron Man would have looked like back in the back in 1990, I dread to think. Because if you see what Thor looked like, you see what Daredevil looked like, how would have done Iron Man? I have no idea. But it was just that period was like an interesting little thing that Marvel were doing, you know, trying to expand, you know, their universe and everything, and just trying to sort of, you know, just branch out a little bit with what they were doing.
Okay, that's cool. All right, let's. That's going to wrap up our movie talk for today. Let's wrap up our final segment. As always, Dazzle, what are you reading as of late?
Well, this week I read Secret Wars issue 9 to finish off the.
Now I'm curious what your thoughts were, because mine, as someone who's a big Hickman mark, I was a little disappointed the way it ended. It's like I expected this, we had this big, gigantic run that was going 3 years, and we've seen the stuff that he's done in Fantastic Four. So I had my expectations really high, but I felt like it underperformed. But I'm curious to what you thought of it.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I've not read the Hickman run on Fantastic Four, so basically I've only had Secret Wars as a saga to go on. Mm. And I've basically been less and less interested. I thought it started great. But as it's gone on, I've just found it sort of got I just wasn't engaged in the characters. I didn't really care about the characters or what we're doing. And when it got to the final issue, the first time I read it a couple of times, and the first time I read it, I was just kind of, it's one of those things that I think it's more with me rather than the actual comic, in that sort of comics have basically gone to a place where I'm just not into anymore. I couldn't really get a grasp of what was actually going on at times and everything. It just seemed to be just like making stuff up as went along. I mean, the whole thing with the Molecule Man and everything. I kind of like that it all ended with a fight between Doom and Reed.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, I don't know. Even that, there wasn't like sort of, I couldn't really see the purpose of the actual, the battle between them, because it just seemed they just were battling, and then Molecule Man just pretty much said, okay, I'm choosing a winner, sort of thing. I just was not enthralled with it at all. I think the problem with me with a lot of these sort of sagas is that when you have like a main title which is sort of at the crux of the actual story, that story is never strong enough on its own just to read. Mm-hmm. You need to read all the sort of like the accompanying series, the tie-ins, to basically sort of, make something of it. It's like the big battle scene in the previous issue. A lot of it was kind of just like left me nonplussed. The only thing that I sort of liked was when Thing fought Galactus. And the reason why I think, that sort of meant something to me is that I'd read Siege. So the whole Thing's predicament I sort of understood, and that led into the series. But as a whole, I just found the whole thing just sort of, I just didn't care what was going on. So I basically gave it a real thumbs down. Yeah, it just, as the whole Secret Wars thing is just, it's just something I just found really frustrating the whole time I've read it. It's just sort of like, I just really didn't care about it at all. And this was something that I wanted to read to sort of like, ignite my interest again in comics, in today's comics, I should say. And this just did not, do it for me.
Oh, that's a shame. Oh, well.
It's one of those things that I'm kind of sort of at the moment in trying to figure out where I'm going to go with my interest in comics, because Marvel is basically, with the exception of the Star Wars comics and some of the comedy ones like Howard the Duck, today's Marvel's just not doing it for me. With all the endless reboots and with the sort of, the way the stories are, it's just not fitting. So I'm sort of wondering whether I should basically read older comics more, or should I basically go more like down the independent road and trying to find something which is going to engage me? You know what I mean?
Yeah, believe me, if you want plenty of modern day comics to read, you can always listen to our show. There's tons of stuff that we can recommend. And as far as Marvel, I'm sort of there with you in the sense that I'm not as excited in the current direction they're going. But with that said, as always with all things comic books, variety is always the key. So chances are, if you don't like most of the titles, there's going to be stuff you like. And for me anyway, the stuff I really like is Ultimates, I think is really good. I want to recommend that. That's my number one Marvel title I recommend above everything. And then Uncanny Inhumans, I think, is also a really good book.
Yeah.
And then stuff like Vision is it's a good series, but it's an acquired taste, so I understand that most people aren't really digging. But yeah, all the mainline titles like Avengers, Spider-Man, all that kind of stuff, X-Men to a degree, I'm just like, I don't care. Guys, I don't care. I mean, I'm glad you're trying, but some of the directions and some of the writers that they have, I'm just like, yeah, I'm not digging it. But like I said, there's the key to comics is there's variety, so there's plenty of stuff out there.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, Dazza, get your plugs out of the way. What have you been writing as of late?
Okay, well, a couple of things just to plug from the website. I did a piece on X Factor, and when I say this, I'm not talking about the comic or the really bad wrestling.
Oh.
Basically, the reason is the television show. Actually, I don't even know if they call it X Factor in the US. It's based on Simon Cowell's.
It's called X Factor here. Yeah, it is.
It's called X Factor there. Yeah. Basically, the reason why I mention it is this, I've had quite a few people who I know who've read it who don't normally read my stuff because they're not into MMA or wrestling or comics at all. But they read that and they really liked it because it started off, I was basically doing it as part of my Full Britannia series. It's just a bit of a fun piece about stuff that was bad about the UK. But when I started reading it, writing it, there was always like what I thought was like important points about sort of reality TV show and that sort of thing. So I basically just take a look at that because basically there's stuff I talk about like music, but more what a show like X Factor is actually, how it deceives you as a viewer. But also some of the things which I think are quite disturbing, I mean, what we do for ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it's just a piece that I sort of write. But like I say, other people have sort of read that sort of thing, have read it, have sort of like said, yeah, I agree with a lot of points in. So it's just something different that I've done that other people might like. And also, I just want to plug as well, if you like MMA, Coughlin's piece that he did on Sakuraba, I really recommend. I think it's one of the best things that has actually been on the site.
There you go.
Since its inception, it's just. I mean, I came to MMA after Sakuraba's like real high.
So you came early in the game then, huh?
Sorry.
So you came awfully early then. If you're talking about the fall of Sakuraba.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I actually I watched UFC 2 around about the time.
Mm-hmm.
On a videotape, but I didn't become like an avid fan until a lot later. I think I really started. It was around about when Ultimate Fighter came along, the second season of.
Okay, that's when most people watch. To be fair,
yeah, that's when I really sort of started, in that. But Sakuraba, that era had already sort of gone, so I never. When I got into it, I started watching the whole Pride tapes and stuff like that. So I'd seen most of his fights, but I didn't really know the context of why he was so popular and why the whole thing with the Graces and the 90-minute matches, everything, why all that was such a big deal. And so, you know, Coughlin's piece basically puts that into like real perspective. And it's just a really, really, you know, well done piece about Sakuraba, but also a portion of history of MMA that I think are probably not a lot of people, you know, for later fans like me, sort of appreciate. But that piece I sort of thought was like a really, really good one. So if you are have any interest in MMA at all or sport in general, really recommend having that a read.
Okay, and if you're just listening to the podcast, look in the description. We'll link to those articles. So if after listening to the show you're interested in reading those articles, they'll be linked in the description. It's funny, the thing, you ran the gamut of literally in this show, we've talked obviously comic book TV series, but then you talked about the fact that you read this article about X Factor, and then you sort of round up your discussion of stuff that you want to plug is the Sakuraba article, and that's the key to this site, halfguard.com, which I gotta give major props to Mike Coughlin here. It's an MMA focused website, but that's not to say, you know, we're only committed to just doing that kind of stuff. So it literally runs the gamut of everything.
Yeah, it's pretty much like anything goes. You know, Mike's often said to me, like, you know, if it's something that you can make entertaining, just send it and we'll, you know, put it up there. It is an MMA site, but we want to do other things as well.
Yeah, it's a pop culture. To me, my way of looking at it, it's a pop culture site with an emphasis on MMA. But with that said, there's nothing, off limits.
Exactly.
Okay. So I think that's going to do it for this week's show. So from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out the show. And as always, see you guys next time.